Okay, so the first thing I gave you was the Neshe Chachma. So the Neshe Chachma points out a detail of the Braita of Lo Yaseh Bayit Tavnit Heichal, which is that in the list of things you're not allowed to make, you would think that the primary thing you're not allowed to make would be a mizbeach. Right, that would be a credit, that's needed, because if we're trying not to, allow copies of things that are essential to avoda. So if you ask me, which is more like it, somebody building a shulchan like the shulchan, or somebody building a mizbeach like the mizbeach, you would think the mizbeach is a much more serious problem. So the absence of a mizbeach is quite striking. So he gives you a set of explanations as to why it wouldn't have been included. But I want to distinguish here two conceptions of the term why. One explains the motive, so to speak, and the other explains the reason. This would be better if I could remember the four Aristotelian types of causes, but I never can. Aristotle has four kinds of causes, and it's really very useful to distinguish them, but I never can remember which one is which. The motive is the ultimate cause or something, and the reason is, I forget, whatever. Be as it may. So, let's suppose that I'm trying to set a certain halachic principle, but I know there's a precedent that I can't explain away. So I will design the law around that precedent. So my motive, so to speak, for doing it, right, is that I know that I can't formulate halacha which ignores that precedent. But it doesn't give me, right, a conceptual explanation, right, as to why the law is that way. It just explains why I have to frame the law that way, because I have to frame the law to account for that precedent. And it's possible to explain, right, the mechanics of how somebody reached a conclusion without any understanding of what they thought about the substance of the law. Right, they reached, this is what they said in order to reconcile this with that. Okay, so here, right, the Neshe Chachma says, I can tell you why the author of this Braita did not make the assertion that it is forbidden to make copies of the Mizbeach. And the reason is that there is a pasuk in Yehoshua where the Bnei Ever HaYarden build a mizbeach, and Pinchas is sent as Grand Inquisitor to find out if they should be, or if we should launch a civil war and turn them into Yerni Dachas, but the outcome is no, and nobody says anything about destroying their mizbeach. Right? They maintain it. So the Neshe Chachma thinks that this presents an insuperable obstacle to the clearing that it is prohibited to do this. Okay? Now, so now we have mechanically, anyone approaching this sugya has to first of all, right, here's this, if you go through your decision tree, first of all you have to decide, is the absence of Mizbeach significant? I don't know, maybe Mizbeach is just a list of things, maybe there are other, right? And that ties into the question: do we believe that the Braita's list of examples is comprehensive? That because the Braita lists a shulchan and a menorah, but does not mention a kiyor, that there's no prohibition whatsoever of making a kiyor, like the kiyor. Right? We don't know. Okay. So there are two kinds of ways in which you can validate the Neshe Chachma's question. One is by saying that the list in the Braita is comprehensive, so anything left out must be significant. The other is by saying that no, the list in the Braita is not comprehensive, but any list should have had the Mizbeach on it. Okay, we don't know which of those options Neshe Chachma takes, but it seems to me more likely that he takes the second, which is that he doesn't believe the list is comprehensive, but he does believe that Mizbeach should be on the list. Okay, now, if we say the list is not comprehensive, we don't yet have an explanation of why these things as opposed to others. All right, but the Neshe Chachma is going to make the presumption that whatever explanation you came up with that justifies a ban whatever justifies those should also justify a ban on the Mizbeach. Right, that's the presumption he works with. Okay, so right, and he has so now assuming that you have granted the Meshech Chachmah's question, so now you have right. So now you are compelled to right. Now you're compelled to offer an explanation of either why a mizbeach is well. Actually, you're assuming Meshech Chachmah. So you're assuming that, in fact, it is permitted to build copies of the mizbeach wherever you want. So now you have to explain right. That's the other thing. What's different about a mizbeach, right? I understand the mechanical motive was that in order to that this halacha has to be formulated in light of the pasuk in Yeshua. But that's not right. That's not the reason for it, right? I don't know why a mizbeach is different. Right, so Meshech Chachma offers a set of not mechanical but technical explanations, so to speak. He says that right, it's not possible to ban the mizbeach because there are imperatives to ban it, to build a mizbeach. Okay, and you can't make something usher which is necessary. Right, so in that framework, right, really the prohibition should apply to everything. Right, but there's a counter force. Right, you can't ban the mizbeach because if you were to ban the mizbeach, you would also have to ban these things that the mizbeach is good for. Okay? Now that, of course, leaves the possibility that you could ban it with specified exceptions and say all these other things are banned entirely, but this is only banned, right? This is only banned partially, and we have the following exceptions. Right, which doesn't seem to take it, because mizbeach doesn't make the list at all. Right? Although, of course, you could also claim that is the halacha, and the Braita only listed those things which were banned comprehensively. Right? So we could fit it in that way, and that would explain why it's not in the Braita, even though it's true. Meshech Chachma doesn't take any of these options. So the last line of Meshech Chachma is what relates most directly to our substance. He says, "V'tzarach bir od, v'laydavka be'osel menat lishtamesh bo, menor ladlik bo, shulchan l'nech bo lechem, v'chein kulam kayotze v'ze," etc. So, let's say, Miriam, how did you understand that line?
In terms of the Meshech Chachma, in terms of what it means.
Meshech Chachma, what is the Meshech Chachma saying here?
In terms of the words, he's saying that the Isser is...
The Isser of what?
Of
Lo Tasun Iti. Isser of Lo Tasun Iti, not just about the Mizbeach, but about all of them.
Yes.
Okay.
Is, using it in order, making it in order to use it. But, I didn't really know what to do with, I didn't know why he put it there or how it helped answer his question.
Okay, good. Anyone have an idea of what it does in the Meshech Chachma? Jonathan, what do you say?
I mean, one way of reading it is simply that he's explaining the Pesukim and giving up on the Braita.
Okay.
Right, meaning he's giving into the possibility that finds Mizbeach shouldn't be in the Braita. Now he's just explaining why is it that Mizbeach was mutter.
Uh-huh, okay, good. Right, that's
right,
one possibility.
Not explaining at all why it wasn't in the Braita. Right,
mm-hmm.
Giving up on that. And that's one way of reading it. And then it answers his original question, right? It answers the question of why it was mutter for the two Nefshratim to have the Mizbeach. It doesn't answer why Mizbeach was left out of the Braita.
Right.
Right, that's one way.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can assume that if you have that, it may be, right, that it works with the first set of answers. It may work, right? It doesn't necessarily work without that. Not without them.
How does it work with the first set?
I mean, this is the way you answer the psukim, why you don't have it, why it's not, right, in the price, or why it's not usher, would be, right, meaning, is one of these reasons.
So,
the way I originally read it simply is a different answer which doesn't address the price and addresses just the psukim.
That's where Miriam got us to also. The problem with that is that there's no hint in his language that he's given up on the first question, that he's given up. Right, so is there any way of reconciling that? Anybody have some way in which the last line leaves him explaining why the Braita leaves out Mizbeach? Emily, what do you want to say? Nobody would. Uh-huh. So the problem with that is that he has a right. Is that one of his examples is a Bamat Yachid. Right? So people, so that's true nowadays, probably, unless you live in Haiti. But not so compelling historically, I don't think. Tempting, but I don't think it's compelling historically. Yedidi, what do you want to say?
I was going to say something similar, though I guess I could make a rejoinder to that to say, well, with a Bamat Yachid, right, that does seem to be an exception. Meaning it's, that doesn't seem to be a comparable case. I mean, like, using it for its purpose is either really, really not okay, or really, really totally okay. Not like lighting your own menorah, which would be, if it's a problem only for this reason, and otherwise, right, and for that reason not permitted. So.
Okay, right. I think it's part of it more sharply. Let's say the prohibition is against using mizbeach for purposes other than divine service. But when they're mitzvah to do, what's the big deal?
Right.
Right. That's what mizbeach is for.
Right.
And it so happens that the other things have no use in Avodas Hashem outside,
right,
outside.
There's no heter menorah, right?
Outside of the Mikdash, right? But these things do have. These things do. Right? So we could try that. It would be nice if we said it too.
Right.
Yes, Peter.
We say it's an issue of disrespect, then like menorah, if you use it as your lamp, you can see how it's disrespectful to the Mikdash, and the Shofar, the same thing. Mizbeach is not so much of a way that you could use it that would disrespect the Beit HaMikdash.
Well, I guess you could use it as a for Shechita Chulin.
Right, but why would you need a Mizbeach?
I don't know what a Mizbeach is for, period, so I can...
Isn't it?
What does that mean by Beit Mizbachayim also? What do we think it's going to look like?
That's a good question. So what is it? Wait, so did anybody look at the Zachin Peshet and see what he's talking about?
It's
a misquote. What is it really?
It's Pshachin.
And what is it really about?
It's not Pshachin.
Pshachin.
It's not the Akrava, necessarily.
So it's Be'ach.
You don't check on the Mizbe'ach.
I mean, maybe Mizbe'achayim is
the
Shita part of it.
The Oath
Mizbe'ach,
I guess.
And therefore?
I didn't know what he wanted.
You know what he wanted. Okay. Adina, what do you want to say? Okay, so I think that you know that we have the basic alternative, and I don't know that I have anything further to contribute. So now we can move on to the second half of Miriam's question, which is what does he mean? So Miriam, what does he mean?
The rule of Lutz applies to making an almanac to use it.
Making an almanac to use it. Okay, and he doesn't tell you what happens if you make it for other purposes or actually use it, or if you acquire it, or if you acquire it and things like that. So, really, what I just wanted to get out of here on the substantive level is to recognize that there are some ideas that are just going to right and readings that are just going to keep coming up because they're right because again you have these stress points or themes in the sugya, and one of the themes in the sugya is that the Braita keeps on quoting Lo Ta'asuin and referring to Shamashim. And it keeps using the language of Shamashim, and Shamashay Elyon, Shamashay Tachton. So there's always going to be somebody, right, who senses the language is going to say, there has to be some way that the word Shamash, why does it keep saying the Shamashay Elyon, and then Kigon? Right, so if you're reading the Drasha Lecha, what it sounds like is, here's the Drasha, right, Lo Ta'asuin Iti means, don't make X, and we get that from the pasuk, and then we have the examples. So there are always going to be people who have to find shimush in there some way. How much shimush they get in there, right? So you can say, right? So you might say that it's asi al manas lishtamesh. It might say that it's asur either to do or lihishtamesh, or you might even get the wild position that really asiya means lihishtamesh, right? Which we right, all of which we saw. But they're all just coming from what they're coming from is they can't see how the word shamashim keep getting into the braita. And in case you think it was just a local tradition, guess look, here we are, the Meshech Chachma, you know, apparently coming out of nowhere, right, just developed this new claim, right, this new claim that it really just means Asi al Manas Lishtamesh. And I think, right, I just want to point out, and you have to decide for yourself. You can decide it's just, that doesn't matter, that the word Shemush doesn't, right, doesn't mean anything to you. But there will always be a particular kind of literary sensibility in every age, right, somebody who will say that can't be. And we'll try and find some significance to that. Okay, but then we go to the Rambam, right? So the Rambam in the Perush HaMishnayot tells us that what we mean by what do you mean by the tirat klamal levana that you find on kelim, which makes it necessary to treat these kelim as the serim bahana, does not mean that you draw a circle, or even that you draw a bow. Right? Rather, it refers to some kind of symbolic representation in which the sun is a king with a crown on his head, and he says many of these mazalot and kochavim have these different forms, right? Yomit Tirat Shabtai, Tirat Zachen Shachor V'Yashish, right? So Shabtai, I believe, is Saturn, right? That's right. And Saturn is as an old man. I forget what Noga is. This is why I think that they're I think that these are planets.
Wait, so does that mean when people have the name Shabtai and Noga, they're named after?
After astrological symbol? Could be, I don't know.
So means like after.
We call the days of the week. Sunday, Wooden Day,
that's
this
only
day.
In
Wednesday, Thursday.
No, that's only in English.
Ah, so we couldn't call, so you can't call your children Tuesday or Wednesday?
No.
Ah.
It's
Ah. If you really think it's Esther, then you have a problem. I don't know that no one here is saying it's Esther to believe. I mean, the Rambam is saying that it's Esther to believe these things, but he's not, you know, but he's by no means a universal position about this. And I think Gil Student just published something in his blog about rationalist astrology. And we recognize that, you know, Johannes Kepler discovered the elliptical orbit was the court astrologer, not the court astronomer.
Does Shabtai show up as a name early in context other than that?
I don't know. I can do a
graphic. I could see it being that, right, the names of, right, the Greek gods or
yeah.
Titans or demigods, in order to avoid mentioning them, they get sort of Hebrew more neutral Hebrew equivalents that are used.
Could also be.
Yeah.
I don't know. Looking up Shabtai in rabbinic literature. Kufat Nisan b'Shabtai. Don't know. Right, Haiman de Bishabtai. So it clearly is an astrological phenomenon. And there's a name, right? Kihad de Shabtai Bar Marinos, equal above it. So it is a name in rabbinic literature. I don't know more than that.
Shabtai Bar
Marinos.
Probably a Greek name.
Who knows? There's also an Amar Avashi Amar Shabtai. So I can't tell you.
I think it might be better.
They would be careful of their grandchildren. Doesn't Saturn need his kids?
Saturn needs
children. Don't be fooled by the elderly. All right. All right. So Rambam tells you that the pshat in this Mishnah is that we're not talking about. Some kind of representation of the astronomical phenomenon. We're talking about some kind of astrological representation. The obvious thing that sets up then is, if that's what Turat Chama, Turat Levana means in the Mishnah, so what do we say about the Demut Turat Levana of Rav Gamliel, which clearly are not talking about kings on thrones, right? Kings on thrones. Right, so the Rambam has to read the story of Rav Gamliel as fundamentally unrelated to the right to our Mishnah. And that, we point out, is not an unusual claim in the sense that one of the things we noted is that our Mishnah does not play a role in the discussion of Rav Gamliel. This discussion of Rav Gamliel is lifted whole from Rosh Hashanah. It is not influenced by its context in Avodah Zarah. And I argued, but not to great acclaim, that this, in fact, was the point that Rashi was making as well by changing Torah into Mazal in the Mishnah, right? That we're liberating the Sugya of Rav Gamliel from the confines of the Mishnah. Okay, so now that we know the Rambam can essentially remove the Mishnah from the discussion, now we look and see what he does with halacha. So he begins by saying, "Tzurot she'asum of dekochavim lenoi mutarim b'hana'a, v'tzurot she'asim levdekochavim asurim." Right. So the first thing we learn out is that the Rambam thinks that the prohibition of keeping stuff that other people made or getting benefits out of other people made does not apply to Gentile ornamentation. Right? They, whatever they want for beauty, it doesn't matter what they paint. Yes.
Does this weigh in on the brief discussion that was had before in this classroom about whether Hasmana Milti or not?
Well, we could tie it that way.
Because we've been talking about, right, there have been discussion about the mission as to whether or not it was, right, whether we were talking about Bipnishan and Avadi Pamachat Hashana, right, it seems to be a discussion of whether or not they're actually worshipped, right? And he's talking about things that are made in order to worship.
Yeah, so that we don't know if there's a presumption they were worshipped or not, right? You can solve the whole problem by just creating a presumption that they were worshipped.
Uh-huh.
Right, so that's why it's very hard to prove anything about Hasmana, because you can always just put in the assert, right? Put in the assertion of presumption. Okay, so, right. So Acherim, right? So this Rambam Pasuk is essentially Acherim Asulo, not made love of the Kochavim, is perfectly mutar, right? We don't know if there's an in-between category between Noi and Avodas Kochavim, but I think it's fair to say that the presumption is that the only category of Yisur is Avodat Kochavim, and Noi is just an example of things that are not Avodat Kochavim. Okay, right? So this right? I think we could have fun talking about what constitutes a work of art, right? Like what happens if you get somebody to paint you a perfect copy of the Sistine Chapel, right? But you make sure that the person who paints it is an atheist, right? So what is the right? So what is the work of art? Is it the conception? Pashtus, I got asked this question. It was like a similar question last week about what happens. You know, is there an iser against listening to a recording of Christian music made in a church during services? The answer is, it's a recording. Right? Recording is anything. Right? So, it's easy to be an object. Whether you should do it is a much more complicated question. The question whether it's us or what will be us or. Yes?
I'm just wondering, how did he understand that Lanois is just an example if it didn't say to go? Because didn't we discuss to go with the Mashiach HaKafa as being an issue in its own right of the things to replicate? So I'm just wondering how he thinks Lanois, which is much more concrete, was just an example. Like, where did he get it?
Well, because there has to be a line. There's only unless you have more than two categories. Right? So, one of them, if you assume it's a binary system,
okay.
Right? So then, right, you have to draw the line somewhere. Right?
So he's just saying that Lanois has to be the heading for that entire side.
And
then
you can draw the line where you want. I don't know. I mean, if you assume it's binary, I don't know where you get, you know, you have to come with a third.
The third category is
what? Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it depends on whether it's Shem Hashem. It depends on whether or not it's in part or in whole. I mean, we had all these other different things that sometimes allowed us to be mater and sometimes made us oser. So I mean, we could say that some of them apply to this middle category.
Okay, so there are different kinds of middle categories. There's what you draw. Right, and then what? Right, I thought Rachel's question was about what you draw for.
No, but you could say, let's say you draw for something which is neither noi or avodas kochavim.
Like what?
I don't know.
Like,
I
can't
think
of
a
street sign.
A street sign.
Okay.
So a street sign, maybe then we would import one of the other things and say a street sign if it's made in pieces, it's okay, and if it's made whole, it's not okay.
Sure, there's a word you could use. You don't need to make it up. There's a word between Avodas Kochavim and Noi, which is. Somebody? Tashmish. Isn't it right? Isn't it right?
He's not bringing that up.
Which he doesn't mention at all. Right? So we have to raise. So I have to raise. So,
problematic.
Well, only if you think that category exists, right? So that category exists for the Ra and the Ra, right? But there's nothing in the text which forces you to use that, right? That's why there's a theme in the text which offers an opportunity to introduce the category Tashmish. But anybody who wants to just ignore it and say the only thing the Sugya talks about
is Noi.
Right, or Noi and Avodas Kochavim. There is no in-between category, unless you think Lishma Meid is a category which is worse than Noi. Right, other than that.
I mean, we could say that such a category exists in the Rambam doesn't comment on it.
We could. I want to be careful. There's no, as of yet, we have no basis for introducing the category Tashmish into the Rambam. We have no hint that he is aware of it as a category. He's entitled, there's nothing in the Sugya that compels him to believe in such a category. Okay, that's all I'm saying, right? He's not, we don't require him to be consciously rejecting the category. Okay. Nanorama, we're going back to Paragimel rather than order here, and that may be a dangerous thing because it may be that you're supposed to read Paragimel with Paragimel in mind, depending on how the Rambam conceives that you're using his work. If you can see that you're reading in order, then that matters. This is a big issue in terms of Gemara also, right? To assume that the editors of the Gemara presume that you read the Perek in order, and therefore when you do a later Sugya, you know the earlier Sugya. Or do you presume that, or do you presume that they read it like an encyclopedia? Right, that you just take whatever interests you, you take out the article on that. So that changes your whole conception of how to read. I think the contemporary consensus is that at least the first sugya in the Perek is treated as an introduction. So we kind of assume that you're supposed to know the first sugya in the Perek, the first sugya in the Masechta. But even there's no concrete evidence of that. Could just be they decided to put introductions in the chapter for anyone who wanted to. But, right, it doesn't mean you read them in order. Okay, so the Rambam says, Astur l'astut to wrote l'noi, v'yafal pi sheina v'rut kofavim. Right, so the way I read that, you'll tell me if you disagree, is that you can't draw pictures for beauty, even if the subject matter of the picture is unrelated, right, is unrelated to idolatry. Okay, so I can't draw a mother holding a baby, and even if it's perfectly clear that this is not a Madonna and child.
So it doesn't seem to be drawn.
Correct. So I should be careful. I shouldn't draw, right? I should also to make Turuk. That would be a better thing. We have no idea what the form of art is right now. Okay. Shenemar lo tasuniti. Okay. So lo tasuniti is treated as a generic prohibition against any kind of tura. For any motive, right? Then he goes on to say, "Kilomar, lotini ti kilomar turot shel kesef v'zahav sheinam el lanoi kadei shel yitu ubeho behu hatoim v'damu shehem levadok kochavim." So now the Rambam throws in two huge things, which were not anywhere in the Gemara. So the first thing is exegetical. He's making it a question in terms of pshat and chumash. What's his point? Kesef v'zahav, right? It's a big problem in our Gemara. Our Gemara leaves out, right? Our Gemara never discusses the question of kesef v'zahav, except in the context of menorah, and we get rid of it there too. We say that you can make the menorah out of anything as long as it would be kosher for the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, so the Rambam does not take the option some people take, which is to repunctuate the pasuk as lo ta'asuni ti elohei kesef elohei zahav lo ta'asu lachem, right? And so just bracket that. And then so we have to get the kesef and zahav. What's the other part of the verse that we have to solve?
Elohei,
right? It's a picture against, right? It's a prohibition against making gods. Okay, so Rambam solves that by saying kadei shel yitzu b'hem hatoim b'yidamu shein levadav kochavim. Okay, so Rambam interprets lo tatsun lochem elohei kesef elohei zahav. Don't make things that are ornamental like gold and silver that people might eventually come to consider gods. Okay, that's right, and that is his shot in the pasuk. So you understand, right? There's a lot of stretching in that. Yes, Emily.
Okay, so in the first part he says to Rosh Hashanah, we'll take Kochavim Lanoi and turn to Hana'ah.
Yes.
And now he's saying that Lanoi, Apple, Pisha, Ina, Avada, Kochavim.
Yes.
Meaning you're allowed to get Hana'ah from them, but you're not allowed to make them.
That's right. Good question, right? He does not make reference, so far as we can see here, to any sort of chashada. Okay. So the Rambam tells us that the whole prohibition is... Yeah.
You were making it seem like it was a big stretch. You could make a good argument that's shot in the puzzle.
Yeah, right? Okay, yeah.
And to say, right, because the E.T. is not a noun, right?
Yeah.
And so that's actually a very simple reason, right? Don't make with me, right, gods of silver and gods of gold.
Yeah, but he doesn't say gods of silver, but they're not gods and they're not silver and gold. They're anything which is pretty like silver and gold, or is anything other people might consider gods.
Right.
That's a stretch.
Oh, right.
Right. In terms of the grammar, it's fine. Right?
He's
reading of the phrase that Lahik has laid the hob. That's a stretch.
He's stretching the midrashic power of the baraito in order to get them to the pshat of the pasuk as he sees them.
So the
baraita is offering is offering things aside from silver and gold.
Right.
So, but the pasuk says silver and gold. So how is it? Because it's like
yes.
Right.
So that's right. That's what I'm saying. So that's you want to claim he doesn't think that's pshat. He thinks that's the pshat the medrash offered. Fine. But he thinks it's important to stick the medrash into the medrash into the pasuk.
Yeah, no, he thinks that the medrash has something to do with what the pasuk is saying. So he's trying to illustrate the conceptual bridge between what ends up actually being usher and what the pasuk seems to say literally.
Okay, but literally that sounds like
it makes a lot of sense.
Another way of saying it. Yeah, because you don't really believe that's what the pasuk means. You think it's what the pasuk means conceptually. And he's just sort of pretending to you that that is what the pasuk actually means. Because conceptually, you think it's plausible that the ground of the pasuk is to ban anything that might eventually be used for avodah zarah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why are we not taking kesef and zahav as just kesef and zahav?
Why? Probably because the brayta doesn't seem to. No one mentions it.
Because
no one says. Well, he tells you in a moment. The next line he won't tell you. He'll tell you he can't.
Line, yes.
That's necessarily
talking about the same thing.
Lechora, we'll talk about it in a moment, but I don't see anything else we could talk about. But you're right, we could, at this stage, we're right, that we have not yet...
Because it sounds like when you go to Kuma Tzor, Shokan Zidahar, Shainam, Illinois, it sounds like just silver and gold.
That's right, now you're right, that there's nothing that we have read so far that compels us to believe anything other than he just talking like the pshat of the pasuk in terms of gold and silver. Maybe only gold and silver. Could be. You're right. So let's read the next line and see if there's a way of reading the whole thing together.
Well, I mean, unless you separate from Adam and other things,
Well, so how do you read the line? Ve'inah through Illinois, elot zerat Adam bilvad. So you want to claim it? You want to read that line as that it's not forbidden to draw things for beauty out of materials other than gold and silver, except for zerat Adam. That seems a little bit. So that's what you need to do. You need to find a way that you can reconcile that. Yes, Rachel.
I'm just wondering, before understanding like the halakhic ramifications of this line about let's throw Illinois and let's have them build that, why does it say let's throw Illinois as opposed to let's throw Illinois?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Good question.
Okay.
Very good question.
Unless
there's two different terms, that would help Miriam, right?
Okay.
If you want to claim that there's an Isur Lassot to wrote that applies only to gold and silver, and there's an Isur Lassur that refers to Afghat Adam. That's clever. Right. You can go look and see if somebody else has thought of it first. Or if you think you're confident enough to advocate it yourself. I'm open to either. Now you two of you have it together, right? You have room for a shot. So if you have time, I'll bring in a Frankel Rambam and go look it up and see if anyone previously has thought of this. Do you have a Frankel Rambam there, right? So we have one up there, so you can check afterwards if anyone thought of it. Okay. So the problem is, so Rachel and Miriam point out what might be the theme in the Rambam, which is why he frames it, why he doesn't just write one sentence. Right?
And at least if he was going to be repetitive, why
did
he
put
the same format, which he hasn't done?
Exactly. Right, then you have a second theme, he doesn't even keep the exact same verb. Right, so those are excellent points. And somebody should have noticed them and come up with something along those lines. And if they haven't, then that's a contribution at least. To point out, this is what it should mean, and everybody else can react to it and say, nah, but someone has to have pointed out. Okay. Lefichach, emes tzayim, lo be'etz, lo be'siv, lo be'evin, tzorat adam. Right, which is, v'hushati ha'tzorat boletet, g'yon ha'tziyur v'akiyur sh'betraklin v'chayot ziben, I don't know what those are, v'im tzar loke. Okay, so we get our pasuk, gimel is an apchret, is what seems to be a prohibition against making anything, no matter what. The ground of this prohibition is so the to'im won't make an error and believe. Now, interesting thing, right? What is the Rambam's concern? What is he afraid is going to happen?
The people will mistaken it for being used for.
People will mistake, right? So is he worried about people
actually worshiping it?
No.
He's just worried about
yes. Exactly right, right? Exactly right. So Nalman's formulation sounds like he's worried, right? The whole ground of the prohibition is, right, is a chashad that people will think you made things for Avodah Zarah.
I'm not convinced
of the
Why?
The other possibility is people are afraid they'll say that these are prohibitive kohavim and worship them. Right, so just, right, that's the same thing as Asim Lishtameish, right, the question we had earlier, right, maybe the prohibition against us, right, Lassod Al-Manas Lishtameish is, and a presumption that you're a Mishtameish, that's why they're Asim. So I think that we, I think...
You do ban Atoim, doesn't sound like, it's usually...
Sounds like it means idolaters as opposed to the...
You do ban Atoim, usually means people who are, right, astray, right, they are doing something wrong.
Well, they're making an intellectual error here. I don't know. I think I'm open to either explanation. My tendency is to substantively I like Jonathan's reading better, that people will actually worship it. But the language is not so great. Not so great. Okay. The tension that Miriam Rachel played out is correct, is that
and just considering
yeah.
The Rambam. The Rambam uses Tohim every single time he's talking about someone who worships Avodah Zarah, right? The first halachamas of him, the entire first parak, right? It's Bimei Enosh, Ta'u B'nei Adam, Ta'u Gadol B'nivra, Atat Tochmei Avodah Zarah B'Enosh, Atmomen HaTohim Haya, right? In Halacha Gimel, V'yada Shekol Olam Tohim V'Davar Shekar, right? Ta'a, Ta'u is the word throughout all of Avodah Zarah B'Enosh that talks about someone worshipping idols. I find it extremely unlikely in the context of all of Avodah Zarah B'Enosh that's not what he means.
I agree with you. On the other hand, his language is not precise. So if I had to choose, I would choose that. So I read it initially. On the other hand, the question is, if he doesn't mention chashad anywhere, then that makes it more suspicious the other way. So, I don't have a convincing read at this stage. Okay, then we get to the Tabat thing, which we're gonna bracket for now, right? And then he tells you, right after he says, "Ein asrul asrul noy el asrata dam bilvad." So here we get the two formulations that are dizzy and confusion, like Boston intersection, right? The chena through the sword must come alav anak kochavim mazalo de malachim, right? So how can you simultaneously say the ena? Right, first you say asur lasot, then you say venasur ella, and then you throw in but ella meant ella this and that. So the formulation here is dizzy. The chena through the sword must come alav anak kochavim mazalo de malachim, shneimar lo tasuniti. Lo ta'asun kidmut shamshay ha-mishamshin lefanai b'marom v'afilu al haluach. Now, where he gets afilu al haluach from, I'm not quite sure. Probably Rabbi Gamliel. Okay, but he tells you, tzurat ha-beimot, ar nefesh chaya chutz min adam, v'tzurat ilanashin d'arim v'chayitem mutar l'tzuratam v'afilu haita ha-tzura boletet. So, the question is, when he says, l'tzurat d'mut chamal v'nak v'chavim mazalot v'malachim, what does the Rambam think? Well, we'll start with an easy question. What does the Rambam think a malach looks like? Nothing.
Not like
a malach looks like nothing at all. So, now, if you take that as dispositive, right, that the Rambam, but the malachim cannot mean what a malach looks like, because the Rambam doesn't think a malach looks like anything. So the next, right, so then we can move on to the next question, which is, when he says to wrote, when he says "Dmut Chamal v'Nal Kochavim Azalot Malachim," does he mean the things that he talked about in the parish of Mishnayot, or does he mean the actual images of the sun, moon, stars, planets, and angels? All right, so that's the really challenging thing. Right, is it plausible in Rambam for angels to mean the way angels appear to us, in the same way that all the other Rishonim did? And so what is he really banning? The problem is that on the bottom, he allows, right, there's this conspicuous lack of astronomical phenomenon. He could say, throughout the paymot, the igul ha-chama, the igul ha-bana, etc. He doesn't tell you that. So we have a middle term that the Rambam doesn't leave defined, which is actual pictures of astronomical phenomena. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, I don't remember, but I thought we did another source earlier about
or at least discuss them all seem resembling human beings at least when we see them. So is it possible he is including that because he's already made the assumption that Sura Adam is prohibited and therefore this would obviously follow because technically it's not a...
The Malachim doesn't add anything at all.
He said you is just as appropriate in the list of things as Kohanim and Malachim.
So what does he prohibit when he says you can't draw Malach? What does he prohibit?
It's really prohibiting to do Adam even if it's with the mind of drawing Malach.
It's the same picture as before, which he banned under any circumstance, any intent.
Okay.
So I'm. It's combining two brachos,
right.
And he leaves out Ofanim and Srafim. Mm-hmm. So right, so he's not. So it doesn't seem quite right.
If he means right, Mukhamalos and Akhavim as Alos and Malachim here, all in the sense that he used in the Sefer HaMitzvot.
Yeah. Oh, not the Sefer HaMitzvot yet. All in the sense of
the Sefer Mishnah. The Sefer Mishnah, right?
Yeah.
And so these are all right pictures of people that are meant to represent sun, moon, and stars and stuff, right?
Yeah.
And right, this
don't
could
look
be the answer. Right. No. So this could be the answer to the rejoinder. This is not a Surat Adam. This is Surat Hamalos Anah. Right. He says no. Still just as bad.
You want to go with Rachel and say that it's not just Malachim. All of these are Surat Adam.
Right. It could be right, but it's not redundant because right, people don't necessarily consider it Surat Adam.
So it's not redundant, but it's also not contradictory.
Right.
Right. Because it's still clear that those are the only. Those are the only prohibitions. Interesting. That's interesting. The problem is he leaves out the middle term, right? Is that he never tells you about whether it's up to draw astronomical phenomena or not directly. So it's very hard to figure out what he meant. Right? He should tell us, right? If he's only referring to the images of the mazel of the right, the symbolic images, then why right, he should tell us? But it's permitted to draw a sun and a moon.
But he already did by telling us, right? The answer that through the night. Ella through
Adam Levad. Interesting.
I'm not sure I'm convinced myself, but I think it's.
That's very interesting. Okay, what else does he do to the Gemara? Right? What does he do to the Gemara that no other Rishon has done so far? But he transforms the right. He transforms. If you see it, right, what the Rish did, right? The Rish just quoted all the brights out of the Gemara. Right. So what does he do to the brachot as opposed to just quoting them?
Combines them.
Good. What does he combine? Which means he eliminates what distinction? He eliminates the Mador Elyon and Mador Tachton, and he can place them all into Mishamshin, right? Mishamshin Lefanai
V'Maro. I mean, not that he doesn't think the distinction exists, he's not relevant.
Well, it depends whether you have the Girsa Mamarom in the Gemara or not, right? There were some Rishonim who went out of their way to tell you that Marom gets cut out of the first one because the Mador HaElyon, right, isn't Marom, right? So the sun, moon, and stars, right, are in the Shamshin Lefanai, and
only. Still not relevant for Halakha.
Well, it depends on whether you make any distinctions or not, right? Some people have distinct different halachas for each of them.
Oh.
Right, Shamshin Shafar Lasot Kamotan, and Shamshin Shiyash Lasot Kamotan. So what he does is he boils down Lotasuni T, right? So we had four things that Lotasuni T could ban. It can ban Mador Elyon, Mador Tachton, Adam, and Beit HaMikdash. Yes.
So I'm just wondering because he also said the Afilu Ahalua.
Yes.
It seems if we're taking your assumption that is a reference to the Ramon Gabriel issue, then it could be that he's not making any effort to take away that part, that frame, quote unquote, of our whole Gemara, and therefore he believes that that plays a role, and that all of these different proofs of Mador Elyon, Mador Tachton, and all of those following in order were actually supposed to be
related to Rabban Gamliel. But then it has to be real astronomical images, right? If I feel hello off the reference to Rabban Gamliel, then it can't be people anymore. It can't be images of people. It has to be actual sun, moon, and stars. Because Rabban Gamliel showed people sun, moon, and stars.
But then wouldn't that all be concluded if he's using just a heading of Bamarom?
Yeah.
And then he's sort of conflating the things underneath that because all of those were really responses to the Ahaluach situation.
That's fine, but it includes real sun, moon, and stars. You can't avoid that. It's all Luach is rubbing Amliel, and Amliel never gets away from real sun, moon, and stars.
And unless he was showing them pictures of all the men.
Yeah.
Did you do
anything like that? You're God. Yeah.
I see. Okay. So you're saying that that would go into the realm of what he made after before.
Yes.
The question is, how much of the man on the moon did you see?
Or the moose, and squirrel.
All right.
Shouldn't the man be in the lantern?
Yes.
Why are we assuming the same ethos he was talking about in Perish HaMishnah? And you think, maybe if you read the title, like the so-so-so, Anoy Afapisha Enel Vedakta Chavim, you say that even though this is not the ethos of Vedakta Chavim.
Yeah, no, it's perfectly fine to say that this is totally different, right?
Right.
Right. The problem is just that we're sort of bothered by his general, and that, right, we have three statements of his, right? A, everything is forbidden. B, only Adamus is forbidden. C, the sun, moon, stars, and angels are forbidden. And we're just trying to figure out how you put those three statements together, which are, you know, seem highly contradictory.
You could say the word mood means it's Yerushal Sot Mutan.
Uh-huh.
And then you could say the first one says there are some shapes which is not allowed to make, even though they would not be considered a Vedak Kochavi.
And the middle one?
The middle one is saying these shapes are shapes of Adam. Meaning, I don't know the context, maybe he's talking about...
You want to say Asur La Sot, some Tzurut Lanoi, the appellation of Vedak
Kochavi. The first thing is the shape you're not allowed to make, even if it's not for Vedak Kochavi.
And the only example of such a shape is the human, Ein Asur Ella. But, by the way...
Separately, Tzurot Ye'ev Shalot Sot Mutan, there's those Tzurot, some of them are also Asur.
Yeah, that separately is the... You're still putting in a theme that's not... Right, that's not Pashut.
Well, there is no Pashut
way. That's right, there is no Pashut way, right? The Rambam is deeply problematic. There's no two ways about it. The Rambam is deeply, deeply problematic. Okay, right, so we say... We know is that the Rambam... from Lota Asuni Ti, the Rambam definitely gets some kind of prohibition that goes beyond the Avodah Zarah. It seems likely... That really means the human figure, but it also seems to include all shamashim b'marom, which he decides. He doesn't seem to have the distinction between mador elyon and mador tachton. He doesn't seem to have an adam as the category as one of the mishamshim marom, and of course he doesn't mention anywhere here anything about the Beit HaMikdash. Right, so that brings a little bit of bechira, where the Rambam seems for the Rambam. Mentions the prohibition of making a bayit tavnit heichal as one detail of the mitzvah of Yerach HaMikdash, right, which is clearly not in our sugya. Right. Yeah, we couldn't ask for a clearer distinction. Okay, then that the Rambam is consistent about, and gets picked up as we saw by the Sefer Achinach, right, who also puts that into an entirely separate category. What is not clear is the Rambam's position, right, what kind of images the Rambam actually bans, because in the Sefer Mitzvah we seem to have two girsaot, one of which he only bans Surat Adam, one of which he bans even Surat Baalei Chaim. If he bans even Surat Baalei Chaim, that contradicts the Mishnah Torah under any circumstance. Right. If you want to think he changed his mind, you could have fun thinking the Mishnah Torah represents, you know, that both positions got stuck in by accident, which happens sometimes, right, the places he forgot to change his mind. But...
Unless minei ba'alei chayim...
Yeah. Certain kinds of ba'alei chayim.
That is only Adam at... Yeah. And he later says, Eizem mina tzurot motel tzairam, Eizem
mina. Right. And I gave you the Ravid who tried, the Ravid who noticed something like what Miriam and Rachel as a possibility going on. He seems to make distinctions here and doesn't understand how they can make these distinctions. Neither do I. Okay, we are going to, you know, you are welcome to develop whatever position you want in terms of what you think the Rambam's underlying position is. For fun, I pointed out that in the end of Sefer Mitzvot, he says, Lutz Lutz Tzuniti is really about, not like some other stuff, which is not our thing, what Lutz Tzuniti is not about, because he's into Pasha Pshat and the Psukim, as we can see in the Mishnah there also, right? Everything has to be. All right. You might think that it sounds like the Rambam had some issues trying to get this Gemara to fit. Okay. So that brings us That brings us to the Bir HaMitzvos of the Bir HaMitzvos Prolo. So here I want to, it's probably worth doing a brief excursus on particular kinds of soapful, and this one in particular.
Yay!
So this is a method of analysis that really I learned from Rosenzweig. It was when I was first in a Rosenzweig shir, which is frighteningly 26 years ago. So one of the things that made it really, really exciting for the first semester, which is how long I lasted, was the first, we spent about the first 4 months not getting to Gemara. Because we just did Sifrei HaMitzvot. And this person, I'd never heard of these Sifrei, other than the Chinuch, I'd never really heard of any of these Sifrei HaMitzvot. The Urayim, I'd never heard of the Urayim. What was the Urayim? And the Smog, I might have heard of the Smog. The Smog, you know, it was a wild thing, and it was all about trying to figure out what the Ur-Lav of Gezela was. The Ur-Lav, right? The love from which, if there is such a thing, the love from which everything branches out. Right? So you have this complex of prohibitions, all of which seem to center around the attainment of material by illicit means from other people, or the maintaining other people's property illicitly, right? So you have Geneva and Gezela and Losachmon and Losashok and Losis Aven and Shalach Yad, and right, other cases like Shalach Yad Vikadon, and you're trying to figure out how do these relate to each other with a bias towards believing that one of them is the core concept that is the basis of everything, and the others are somehow least of it. And I think Rosenzweig's favorite was claim Losachmon was the key one, and frankly everything else comes from that. It was really cool. It was a totally new way. A new way of learning. I had never seen anything like it. And it opened up this whole world of Sifrei HaMitzvos to us. But now we have to think about, there are certain presumptions behind, even without the specific bias towards looking at a single conceptual frame, not a dispositive bias, because you could also end up saying, you know what, there are two kinds of things, of wrong ways of taking things from people, but you didn't really like it to be six. Six was messy because it was hard to believe that there were really six really precisely conceptually core different ways of taking stuff wrongly from other people in a way that matters. But this rests on the assumption that the categorization into mitzvot is a meaningful endeavor, not just legally but conceptually. Now here we have to think about this whole concept of 613 mitzvot. You all know how we know the 613 mitzvot, because Torah is Tzivah Moshe, and Torah is 611. Beat, or Gemara Makos, because Anochi and Yelecha Hashem told us directly, and that's how we get 611 gets to 613. That's the whole source. That's all we know. Not the world's greatest drasha of all time. Well, that's a whole question, right? You know, but you can always combine it, you know, to whatever.
Then right? You have to do that.
Yeah, the sugyan Makos ends up cutting them down to one, right? So that's all right. Tzadik b'mna toyich here. Ramban goes, you know, Ramban at the beginning of his commentary Sefer Mitzvot spends some time agonizing about this and decides in the end that the evidence for it is so weak that it must be a Masoret.
Or
it's not. Yeah. But, all right, it won. So we're going to, you know, so it is a legitimate aspect of Talmud Torah to try and play this. And you can imagine that there's this giant game of musical chairs going on among Sukkim. Right? They only have 613 seats. Mm-hmm. And you've got 700 or 800 people wandering around, and you play your Lundish music, and then 613 get to sit down, and the rest of us have to sit on left. Right? That's basically that's not how you play?
You get out.
Yeah, no, can't do that, right? You have to sit on left.
What's that?
Right, no, so it's important to understand that nobody... so it's important to understand that nobody really thinks, right, nobody starts off playing the Sefer HaMitzvot game trying to figure out what's Asur or Mutter. Right, the Sefer HaMitzvot game is an intellectual game, not a halachic game. Right, and the game is to figure out how you get all the known halakha to fit into 613 categories. Now, like all such games, right, eventually it bleeds back, right, it bleeds backwards because your decisions end up having consequences. But no, but you're not allowed to play the game in order to get the consequences. Nobody says, well, I'm going to count this mitzvah and as opposed to that mitzvah because I think this ought to be mutter. Right? Nobody does that. Right? Right? The given is that all of halacha is somehow included in, right, somehow included, and you have about 800 candidates, right, to include them, and again, you know, 613 of them win. Okay. Now, the from Rosenzweig's assumption is that the 613 categories end up being conceptually significant categories. Right, as opposed, right, you know, that it would be cheating to say, well, you know what? There's no place else for this to fit, so I have to stick it in here. Right. You don't want each mitzvah to have its core elements, and its miscellaneous elements have to go in somewhere. Right. This is parallel to the machloket about Melechet Shabbat. Right. So if you think whether you think that the 39 categories generate the Isurim of Shabbat, right, or whether you assume that we already know what's Asur on Shabbat and then we have to stick it into 39 categories. Right. And then the things that we can't really stick in, so we have Makiv and Patish. Makiv and Patish is always useful. Right. As the miscellaneous category. And we don't know why Zora, Borer, and Rocket all got seats. All right, it seems really kind of unfair that Zora, Borer, and Rocket all got seats, and Kotesh didn't. Okay. Now, there's a second issue which is sort of parallel to the Sefer Mitzvah, not identical, but sort of parallel, and sometimes they conflate, which is the question of whether a pasuk, right, as a source for a law, is significant conceptually and not just exegetically. Right, meaning, does it change do we assume that it changes the character of the Isur because you get it from this pasuk and not from that pasuk? Okay, right, or do we just say, look, you know what, you get the laws from the Sukkim. And then when it's done, you build a conceptual framework out of some kind of much broader framework. Does it make a difference if you derive this particular Isur from Losachmo to Losasho to Losisave and things like that? Right. Those are methodological choices you have to make. Now, the thing to get about Yochum Fischl Perlow is that on the surface he cares about none of this. Right. The conceptual issues are not his issue at all. He's playing the mechanical game. Right. The mechanical game is that you have to account for all the laws in 613 categories, right? So it's cheating, right? So whether it's conceptual or not is not his issue. His issue is that it's cheating if you didn't get all the laws into the 613 categories. You're not, right? The rule is you're not allowed to have somebody out of the game. At least not have laws out of the game. You can have psukim out of the game. Right, you can take a particular pasuk and say, you know what, that pasuk is just an Eitzah Tovah. It's not a halacha at all. But you can't end up with halachos that are not in the game. Now the problem is that when you start off, right, you have your 800 candidates, and you basically instinctively assign your 20 billion halachos to their favorite candidates, and right, so these 800 mitzvot are representing these million halachos. Which means that whenever anybody doesn't get a seat, all their laws are up there. Okay, so Rishon Fischl Perlow's game is to try and figure out a way in which all those laws get onto the last pasuk. He doesn't need the pesukim, but he needs all those laws, right, to be on somebody's lap. Okay, now the way you play this game mechanically, right? So here again, I think it's really very useful to think of this holistically as opposed to going in order. So if you want to read, if you want to think about what Rishon Fischl Perlow is doing, right, so reading it in order is a literary presentation, but it's not how he's thinking. What he's thinking is, I have the following laws which fit into the following eight candidates. But not all the eight candidates got a seat, only six of the candidates got a seat. That means I have all these orphan laws that are associated with the other two. I need to figure out how he got
all the laws that were naturally associated with the other two to fit onto the other left. Okay, now he's thinking this on a broad scale, right? So he has a bunch of different people. He has a bunch of different people all play. Like, imagine, like, they're playing computer simulations of musical chairs, right? So each time a different group of people get seats. Right, those are Rishonim. Right, Rishonim each play pick their own game. So he has to play this game according to each of the Rishonim. And every Rishon has to have a way of fitting, right, of fitting the exact all the halakhot onto the lap. Except, right, there, you know, then we can make the game a little more complicated. About some halakhot that are machlokot. Right? So you're allowed, right, so you don't actually have to fit every law, you have to fit one position regarding every law into it. And it's pretty much cheating if you, right, if you make up a new position. Right, unless you can find evidence for it. And he didn't think it. But you can't always win, so sometimes you get to cheat. Now, under the rules of Rechon Sefer Pella's game, you are allowed to make up your oath, though. That is a fair game. You're allowed to say, obviously he couldn't have had that text. Because it wouldn't make sense otherwise. That strikes us as cheating a little bit. But it didn't really strike him as cheating so much. So he will, in fact, in the class of one essay, he may tell you about three or four gears you never heard of before. Some of them will be, but it turns out he has really good instincts. So many of them, right, if you actually go back into the manuscript work, you'll discover they're real. He has really good instincts. Okay. So here we're going to, right, the book he chose to, right, organize around the Sefer Mitzvot HaTzadikon, which is... Well, it exists.
It's not a book.
It's a poem. It's a poem. It's about a
page long.
And so now, that gives him a lot of freedom. Because Rav Tzadikon tells you, no other halakha. So you have complete freedom. But everywhere where there's a choice of the halakha, you have complete freedom at Rav Tzadikon. Because you don't have the faintest idea what he held. So you can choose, right, whatever side, you can choose any side of any machloket, any combination thereof that you think is reasonable. Rav Tzadikon doesn't constrain you at all. Not only that, Rav Tzadikon doesn't use the exact language of the psukim. You have a little bit of freedom as to which psukim you think, right, which mitzvot is actually counted. Okay. This is in Hebrew, I think. This is in Hebrew. There's a different book in Arabic, which I don't think Rav Yisroel makes so much use of. I don't know how different it is. So if you were writing a book like this, this is an enormous opportunity. It gives you complete freedom. Now, what Rav Perla did, though, which nobody else did, was he read all the other Sefer HaMitzvot. Right, and again, now I don't know if he had the kind of memory that it may have been entirely unnecessary, but if you were teaching people how to do this, right, we just imagine you have this giant chart, right, which has the 613 seats, and shows you exactly what choices everybody made, right, and then to control the problem, right, because you don't really want to deal with 613 variables, so you try and isolate the group of potential mitzvot that are related to this topic. Right, so you have your eight or nine possible mitzvot, and that leaves a little bit of freedom because some people gave these 8 or 9 mitzvot 8 seats, and some of them gave them 6 seats, and some of them gave them 5 seats, different seats, right? But that's the game you're playing. You isolate the group of mitzvot that are competing, for these seats. So here we have Lo Ta'aseh Lecha Pesel and Lo Ta'asu Nisi and Yirat HaMikdash and the big surprise, Evin Maskil. Right, you also have Elohei Masecha Lo Ta'asu Lechem, right, which you can bring it or not. Sometimes Sukkim make it, and sometimes Sukkim don't make it. Elohei Masecha Lo Ta'asu Lechem has had a sort of short, unhappy career as an independent mitzvah. A few people quote it, but really, mostly it seems to have been left by the way. But you can also count the Lo Ta'asun Lechem, right? You can count Lo Ta'asun Iti and Lo Ta'asun Lechem. However you parse the, wherever you put the etnasta, you can count that as two separate mitzvot, and somebody does that also. Right, but this is the game that he's fundamentally playing. Then you look for the thing. So the major themes that he has, right? The major points which are the which Opie's analysis are A, people keep quoting Lotasilah Pestle in the wrong place. I mean it right, so I should right, step back. That the when what are the cool things you look for in the you look for here? So the really cool thing, the indication that something is going on, is when somebody seems to be contradicting an open Gemara. Because right, that's when you know they're doing something they believe to be meaningful. Right, the people, right, because some people could just be quoting Gemaras, and then they might be playing a sick stuff, that same game, that wouldn't be so meaningful. But if somebody quotes a different topic than the Gemara, that, by Ruch and Fischl Perlow's rules, is a very significant move. Yes?
Are we assuming they did that because they had a different gear set, according to
Fischl? No, that would be very...
I don't understand why.
They're doing it because they must have thought that they must have some reason for believing that that's the wrong pasuk.
So the Gemara got it wrong.
So no. So then we must say, if the Gemara says this and they quote a different pasuk, that must mean the Gemara is reflecting one side of Machloket.
Oh.
Right. And that must right. Now we can start moving. Okay. Right.
Okay.
So now we know this position that we previously thought was uncontroverted. We thought it was an open Gemara. Since he doesn't quote the Gemara, there must be something else to contradict it. And now we're going to town.
Okay.
Okay. So we can take, you know, it's worthwhile to set up a base, right, and figure the, right, so the base is our sugya, Rabban Gamliel. And our sugya makes the claim that there are four different things you can get of Lota Suniti. Right, you can get Meshamshe Marom, you can get Meshamshe Tachton, you can get Adam, and you can get Terot Beit HaMikdash. And it seems plausible that we right, that Lo Tasuni Tish, right, because of our sugya which says Kitanya Hehil Ovdam, right, it seems plausible that our sugya says Lo Tasuni Tish is unrelated to Avodah Zarah, and Avodah Zarah is unrelated to any of these. Right, that's the surface reading of our Gemara, right, which is that Lo Tasuni Tish is there to create the prohibitions that are not about making things for Avodah Zarah. So whenever anybody quotes a different pasuk from one of those four, or tries to make those things fit into Avodah Zarah, all right. So that's right there. Ruchim Fischl Perlow saying, "What are you doing?" All right, and there he is opening. So we've already seen in the Rambam, right, that first of all he takes Bayit Tavnit Heichal out of Lo Tasuniti. And that he makes everything related to Avodah Zarah. Okay, so we have lots of room. We have lots of room to play in. We have lots of room to play in the Rambam. Armed with that information, Ruchim Fischl Perlow goes to town and says, "Guess what? You know what? If you look at all these Rishonim, you'll discover that there are many, many Rishonim who keep on quoting the wrong pasuk. When they should be quoting Lota Suniti, they don't. They quote Lota Selecha Pesel instead." Right, so what are they doing? Okay, right, so the primary things that he works around are that number one, why do people keep on messing up the relationship between Lota Selecha Pesel and Lota Suniti? And number two, why do people keep on removing Bayit Tavnit Heichal from the realm of Lo Tasuniti. So first of all, I want to just go back to the sugya and point out that it actually is, if you're careful in the sugya, you discover the sugya never actually claims that Bayit Tavnit Heichal comes from Lo Tasuniti. Because there's no brisa which says Lo Tasuniti kigon Bayit Tavnit Heichal.
There's one version of it in the Shilta.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So why don't we go say, so what does the Shulchan actually say?
Also, the Shulchan has two verses which we could
teach. Well, let's just read the Shulchan and see what he says. So what was the argument that they're not? actually, it's not actually there, right? So the opening of it is, that's where again, sorry, I'm just calling it myself. The opening of the Shiltuk is, as I just read, where is the Brayton? Yeah, Tanya Revi Omele said down by the Brayton. So we actually have two, we have two Brayton, right? One of which quotes Lotta Sunniti, and one of which doesn't quote Lotta Sunniti. Okay, our Gemara quotes the Brayta which doesn't mention Lotta Sunniti, and our Brayta also says Kidit. Our Gemara, when it supports Abaye, also says Kiditanya, not Ditanya. So it could be just right. It could be Kiditanya could mean that the halachic conclusion you reached is supported by this Brayta, although not necessarily for the same reason. As opposed to Ditanya, which means that you're getting, that your source is the Brayta. Like, Kiditanya never means your source is the Brayta. Right? Because then you wouldn't say it yourself, right? You just, right? Right, that would be Ditanya. So it could, right? So I think actually this reading is very Midyak, that in our sugya there's no necessary evidence, and I think that's what the Rambam is picking up on. But there's no reason to assume, based on our sugya, that Lotta Sunniti is really, Lotta Sunniti is really the, is really the source. Okay. So these are the details that your official pillar picks up on, and then we just have to play the game mechanically to figure out what goes where. So, right. So his opening question for fun is how can you leave Lotta Sunniti out completely, which he believes Rosh Hashanah did. Right, that's his opening question. Here we have four different things. Our sugya apparently believes come from Lotta Sunniti, and Rosh Hashanah mentions none of them. Doesn't mention the pasuk. So now we can play the game according to Rosh Hashanah Gaon. Where will Rosh Hashanah Gaon put all of those four things? He has a choice. He can either find a different pasuk for them, or he can make them subject to machloket. Okay, so we're going to find two other psukim, at least lo tatelecha pesel, and right three psukim lo tatelecha pesel, yirat mikdash and even maskit. Those are the candidates to work. So in order to get now the only ones that he can get under even maskit and yirat mikdash are only useful for bayit tavne hechal. Right, so the only right so regard to the other three, which is Shamashim Shemador Elyon, Shamashim Shemor Tachton, and Adam, his only choices are either to reject them or to assimilate them to Sukkim and Avodah Zarah. Because we have no other non-Avodah Zarah Sukkim to help us. So he starts by saying that he doesn't think Rosh Hashanah Gaon is a such an outlier, because he sees lots of Rishonim who fail to quote Lotta Sunniti when they should. I think he quotes a long list of Rishonim who keep on quoting in the wrong place, of which the extreme version, right? The extreme version is Rosh Hashanah Gaon doesn't quote it at all. Okay, So Rabbeinu Gaon didn't count it. I'll read down by paragraph. Okay, right, by first line. So then we have the Amnam, right? The paragraph beginning the Amnam Kidei L'Tareis Da Rabbeinu Gaon. Right, we see lots of Rishonim who despite the fact that the Sugya of Avodah Zarah gives you this whole long list of things, right? And really, the Pesukim of Shemayim Al is entirely relevant. But look. Here we have Me'atim Kain Mama Od Yeshli Palei Al Masher Iti B'Tosfot Yuma, right? Tosfot we saw, right? Shakas. Now we get to Tosfot. The Tosfot says Nishalti Al Osam Shemitzarim Masarim Tzurot Chayot Alfot Im Yafehi Masim Veshafti Miu Einkan Isur De Lo Sata Selacha Pesel. Okay. The Afilu Yisrael Mutar La Tzurot Tzurot B'Nei Tzvaim VeEin Bazeh Mishum Lo Tatelacha Pesel. Okay. So this is right. So here's his big problem, right? What's the halamina? Nobody thought Lotta Selecha Pesel would ban drawing nice religious pictures of stuff in Machzorim. The only possible source that is Lotta Sunniti. Right? Nobody thinks that you're drawing about Avodah Zarah statues. right, in Masorim. So now we discover it's not just Rav Sadia Gaon, it's other people who keep on leaving out, keep on leaving out the pasuk of Tosfos NET, and putting something in its place when they really shouldn't. Okay? Yeah? So in the end, he's going to explain that this is a wrong presumption, right?
It's a wrong presumption that it's wrong.
It's a wrong, yes, right? Because we think it's the wrong pasuk, right? But this is, you know, like any grammarian, right? In grammar, like, you know, in Ezra, right? If it happens once, it's a mistake. If it happens twice, it's an exception.
Right. Okay.
If it happens three times, it's the rule.
Okay.
Right. So that's his point, right? You're starting with a presumption that Rav Sadia Gaon is doing something terrible. He's leaving out this pasuk, which just so it seems so central. But if we find every other rishon leaving it out too. Right, and it just means that he's just being a perfectly ordinary Rishon.
Okay.
Right, that's his goal. His goal is to, right, whatever, right, any other parshan. Okay, so he quotes this whole long series of people who keep on quoting Lo Ta'aseh Lecha Pesel, even when they're not talking about things that are made, right, that are made Lenoi. Right, and finally you get to, right, to the smock, right, that's the last of the indented, the last paragraph in the indented section. It says, "V'gam nifleiti b'masher iti l'hasmak v'zalashono shelo la'asod telem d'chtiv lo ta'asu lachem elilim amru batenya afilu shelo la'avod gam l'noy asur v'ein asur rak tzvar adam." What's he doing? Right? How can lo ta'asu elilim mean even l'noy? Our Gemara tells you that the source of l'noy, right? That's right. The source of l'noy is lo ta'asu niti. Okay. Okay. So at the end of this whole argument, he says, "V'hilchach, ein lanu lahamtzi din shum din chadash lispol shum dochek mashmat kushezu dakshinan meikara aled rabbi Gamliel tajvino lechol mai to have a strilan meikara to bechol yinasur v'gam krod lasel lechol pesel l'mayri dafke levdam el afil lenoi bechol atarazu." Okay, so he has one sweeping technical solution to the whole problem. The sweeping technical solution to the whole problem is that the only reason we ever brought Lo Ta'asu Niti in was to try and find a way in which we could say Rabbi Gamliel's pictures were different. Right? To try and find some way in which Rabbi Gamliel's pictures would be okay. We could do that in one of two ways. We could do that either by saying that the sun, moon, and stars are different. But fundamentally, we wanted to say that they were different because something about Lo Ta'asu Niti, right, left Rabbi Gamliel's pictures open. But in the end, all right, it turns out that Abaye and all those brides are irrelevant to Rabbi Gamliel. The real answer is
the plumbing.
So the whole enterprise is gone, and we can go back to a hypothetical default. And the hypothetical default is that, right, the hypothetical default is that what Rabbi Gamliel did is forbidden because lo tasalacha pesel of all these means you can't make anything, period, for whatever reason. Right, so that's right. So that's what he says is right. So he does is right. It's one giant thing. He just eliminates, right. He says this whole sugya, right. And we're saying this is the same thing. It's the same move that the Rif made. Right, except the Rif preserved all the brachot. Right, they said we don't pass like any of the shakla v'tarya, but at least we preserve all the brachot. Rav Perla goes further. He says we just wipe out the sugya. It was all the havamina. And really, the underlying position is that lo tatelecha pesel. Right. So this is sort of the you might call the nightmare artistic scenario. Right. And as we spent all this time showing you, right, how the sugya and the rishonim all create lots of space for allowing something or other, and all the space for the something or other are built around creating exceptions, lo tasun, right, et things like that. So the commissioner says no. Rav Sadia Gaon just didn't buy any of this, because all that's based on this sugya. That's all. Now, what about Acherim Asulo, right? Now it makes a big difference whether you pass in like Acherim, right? Since now, with just a blanket prohibition against anything made everywhere, so it makes a big difference whether you think the Teretz of Acherim Asulo matters or not. Right? Because if you think that Acherim Asulo was a rejected Teretz, and really Lo Ta'aseh Lecha Pesel, right, banned possessing him at all, so we live We live in Rav Yaakov Ariel's Islamic culture. Right? We live in an aniconic culture with no images whatsoever made by anybody of anything. except for possibly Arabesque. Right? Yes.
But working with that, doesn't that mean that the conclusion that reframes our situation with Rabban Gamliel to be not how was it okay that he did that, but actually he sinned, right? That actually he was doing the wrong thing, as opposed to, oh, there must have been a reason why he thought it was justified at the end, it's Shachari Masulo. If we say it's all under Latasa Lachapasal, doesn't that mean that we would say, oh, therefore he went against
it? Well, it depends. So at the end of the Gemara, we learned that Latasa Lachapasal only applies to making it, not to having it made by others. Or Lo Tatel Chapetel allows you to make things in pieces as long as they're whole. Or
does he take this into consideration when he's critiquing?
In the end, he knows there's one teretz that works for Rabban Gamliel. There's one of the three works, either Achrei Masulo or Lifrakim or Lahavin Lahorod.
So, but you were saying that Lo Tatel Chapetel was going to be a sweeping.
That's right.
For all of it. But you're saying that it still could be nuanced in terms of making it in parts or.
Right, so those three answers survive.
Survive, okay.
Right, but all these distinctions in terms of subject matter
were wiped out by Elizabeth.
Are gone.
Okay.
So there's no loy allowed.
Period. Mm-hmm. No sir, Illinois. Now this is the extreme position, right? Now you have the option, once you know this position is possible, you have the option of putting back in any of the bright side you want. Right, the Rish put all the bright side back in. Different Rishonim can put in one or the other. Right, but that's the right. But what I want to show, right, is that the approaches, there's a limited set of approaches, right? You can express them in different ways, and Rishon Lishul Kurlo happens to command such a large amount of material that it comes across as this really elaborate filpul, but it's really the same moves that Rishonim made, same moves Rashi had to make. You have certain themes in the sugya, you have certain themes in the overall sugya, right? Tosfos deals with a lot more data. The Yerucham Tishul Perla deals with a lot more data than Tosfot. Right? What does matter, right, is whether you're a brisker or not, because the Yerucham Tishul Perla is not compelled to offer really rigorous conceptual definitions of what each Yisr represents, as long as he can tell you where everything fits. And if you're a brisker, then you have to think that each of them ends up being coherent, as opposed to just knowing where everything fits. And that's not his game. Right? His game is just to figure out where everything fits back in. Okay, right, so he plays a, right, so then he plays out in the sugya exactly which parts of the, which parts of the sugya you need to, play, right, so, Wafizem melos ha-shapir al-nachon, mashalom manar rabbeinu ha-gon zol lavlo tosuniti, deyesh lomar, degam rabbeinu ha-gon zol, koi b'shid rabbeinu al-yokim b'siyato, v'yokach ha-chersh v'var mana lavlo tzelech ha-pesel v'reif min ha-labin, v'vistrach l'vilu tzu lavlo tosuniti dehihi, v'ray gemura mi-vray tzu mechilta. Okay, right, and he goes back, right, and says, guess what, right, in case you think I'm making this up, right, in case you think I'm making this up and really, right, and really there's no other source, the answer is, yeah, we saw. You can get all these things without Lo Tassuni, if you want. Right, we saw that in the Chilta. So that's right, so he's not creating it. All he's doing is putting all the data on the table and assume, right, and With that basis, it's perfectly possible to construct a plausible position for a side yagon. Okay, then he has a little bit of a tangent in that the side yagon himself, even in this limited work, doesn't seem to agree with this. because he seems to quote language that implies only love dam. Right, here he comes up with the Rambam, right? So on the second page it says Mihu. Yitache Lamar, the Kevan Devadai Tama de Astra Torah Fiat Hatzerot Afil Anoi, Eino Ela Mishum HaChaka V'Ger Elav Adazara. Right, and now we pull out the Mechilta again. Right, what was important to the Mechilta is the Mechilta said, you know what? We Astra lots of things for the sake of Adazara, even though they really shouldn't be Astra, because the Torah goes out of its way. That's how he reads it. And that's how the Rambam reads it. And the Rambam says the reason for this is actually Yitu HaToim. Right? So he says now that don't be bothered if people frame all these Yisurim in terms of Avodah Zarah, and I'm telling you it applies even Lanoi. That's not such a big deal, because the prohibition against things Lanoi is because anything used Lanoi could eventually come to be Avodah Zarah. So here we have the real extreme position that we ban all images, and we ban all images for the same reason. Right, because any image of anything is in a sense is a potential of a desire. Yes, you do.
So I know we like the dichotomy between this and brisk, but this, to a certain degree, this is a conceptual explanation of to give a coherent account of a seemingly disjunctive set of approaches.
Yeah, it is, but it's not.
It doesn't range over the whole thing, but it's right here.
It combines derisas and it combines what we would like to call real prohibitions and prohibitions shema, and we can do it in lots of different ways. But yes, this ends up being he feels compelled need a rationale only because the pasuk says lo tesalocha pesel, not because he is bothered by it, right? He's bothered by the language, right? Yes, Rachel.
This explanation would also work with I think it was with Yedidia's understanding of the Torah as being where we said earlier with the Rambam. His explanation of that it's not the fear of the other people, Yituba Hen Hatoim, the Yuvishan Lavada Kochabim, because Chashan wouldn't play a role in here, because you're saying, well, you have to tell us that, that therefore it would be that you're making the Pesel, because the risk is even if it's Lenoi, you'll worship it, not that even if it's Lenoi, other people might think you're worshiping.
So it ties in better if it's with Jonathan's reading, right? That it's,
oh, yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Ties in better. Sure. Yeah, he's reading it that way. He's reading it that way. Now, but he has boundaries, and his boundaries is he's not willing to make the Beit HaMikdash in Avodah Zarah Rishon. I don't know why. Right?
Right. It seems like if we're going to say that you can't make anything for any purpose, then you would think the Beit HaMikdash would fall under that.
Yeah, I don't know why that somehow seems to push him too far. The thing that you can't write that the Beit HaMikdash is an Avodah Zarah Rishon. I don't know why. But he has another route anyway. His other route is to say that those all fit under Evan Maskit, or those all fit. Okay. I mean, we could, the way to read Rishon LeZrichah, right, is to read the beginning and figure out what it is that he's going to need to say. And then you can bracket everything, and then you just look for where he finished saying what he needs to say. Right? And then you can decide for yourself later whether you need to go through all the evidence that everybody said what he said. Right, but as opposed to reading, if you read in order, right, it's the same thing as Gemara, right? If you read Gemara in order, then you often get lost because there are places where the Gemara is not linear. The Gemara often goes off and off and off, and often it goes back to where it was. So you have to keep track of where you are in discussion. So there's some visual pearl, you have to be capable of doing this really big bracket and saying, what he's saying now, let's say at our beginning, what he says is, so Sadigon leaves out Lotasuniti. But he quotes Lo Tatelecha Pesel. Long bracket. Lo Tatelecha Pesel might not mean just things for Avodah Zarah. Having established that Lo Tatelecha Pesel doesn't just mean things for Avodah Zarah, we can go back and say, oh, that's why Rav Sadia Gaon left out. Everything in between is bracketed. Right? You can replace it all with the sentence, Rishonim who use Lo Tatelecha Pesel beyond Avodah Zarah. Okay, what he does over and over again, right, is you can simplify his equation. Alright, you can simplify his equation and then find these huge brackets, and all that's going on in those brackets is his proof of the equation. But his argument works even if only one of his, right, he might have 20 different Rishonim, but his argument is valid even if only one of them is true. Because he doesn't need any of those Rishonim to be, specifically, he just needs to show you that this is a possibility. Yes, Rachel.
Explaining again, though, then what the function of
Lo Tatsuniti
is.
Depends on the
Rishon. So according to...
Because Rav Sadia Gaon, it doesn't count. Rav Sadia Gaon doesn't count it. It doesn't exist.
Then what does he make of our...
He wipes it out. It's a mistake.
Okay. A large mistake.
It's Havamina. There was a Shita, a biased Shita. The Lo Tatsuniti...
Oh, was a proof. Questioning the proof itself.
Yeah, Abaye has a sheet that he passed in like all these positions that Lo Tatsuniti is a separate Makora for prohibitions that are Lenoi and not Lavodah Zarah. But the Maskana, we don't pass him like that position. We pass him in a Tolkien Lo Tatsuniti
Pesel.
That's it. Okay. Right, that's the broad... Again, you can nuance that for every reason, whenever you want it, right? Abaye only says it about this, right? We accept this interpretation. That's basically the approach. Right? And we got to point out it's the same approach as the Ran and the Riz. It's just the approach that says that once you determine that something is not that something is not necessary, you can eliminate it. Okay, what emerges right in here? You have a whole cornucopia of shitot, right? You can have all sorts of fun constructing the question of whether for the Rambam there even is an issur d'oraisa of bayis havin heichal, because once we don't have lotsa suniti, who says there's a pasuk at all? All we have is a braisa that says you're not allowed to do it. So maybe it's just d'rabbanan. Right, so we discover, right, that we're willing. So you have one extreme of people who are willing to say that if you can't get the pasuk to mean this directly, then it must be d'rabbanan. And the other extreme of people are willing to say, well, even though it's only a siyag, it's still d'oraisa. Right, the people who say the reason that you can't throw Tirol Lanoi is not because we have any objection per se to Tirol Lanoi, it's because any Tirol Lanoi could become an avodah zara. Okay, so the deraisa derabanan dichotomy breaks down because normally we're trained to think that deraisas have to be the thing itself, and the derabanans are the siyag v'torah. Right, but he's perfectly happy saying that they're deraisas which are siyagim. Okay. Yeah, other but there's an article in the I just fight first when I was in 10th grade. It's an article in the Encyclopedia Talmudic on the Xera. You'll see there's a little section on the Xera D'Oraisa.
Yeah,
Rav
Zengel did it before that, and he has 20 examples.
Okay. There is I think the Divrei Yirmiyahu objects to this vociferously and says if it were Xera D'Oraisa, somebody would have told us. Right? You should be willing to say that when you. So he would say, yeah, the Mechilta did tell us. And we go from there. Okay. So we have now, I think we have done roughly a fair set of the Rishonim who address the sugya as commentaries, and the Rishonim who address the sugya in the context of Sifrei HaMitzvot, and you can begin to see, right, different ways of building your own approach. You can build your own approach by trying to figure out what pshat in the sugya is. You can build your approach the other way around and trying to figure out what the categories of Isurim are, and you can connect those to Sukkim. To me, there are the core conceptual issues at stake, if we're doing it as a risk or share, is you have three kinds of prohibitions. You have Avodah Zarah prohibitions, you have Beit HaMikdash prohibitions, and you have this intermediate category of Noi and Mishtamshim. And the really, so Avodah Zarah prohibitions, I think, Lamasa, are pretty easy to get rid of. Right, all you have to do is say there's no, you can find some kind of historical move, if you want to. Right, if you want to ban everything, it's very easy to say, look, everything's a potential Avodah Zarah, go home. If you want to permit everything, you paskim like that shita, and you say there's no Avodah Zarah today. So it doesn't apply. Right, you do that either on a very, very broad scale or on a very narrow scale, and you say the things that were prohibited were things that in that society were potentially Avodah Zarah. Then it means everything, now it means nothing. And that leaves you room, if you want, for giant Hindu statues and somewhere in Pakistan deciding whether you want to blow them up or not. Or in Afghanistan, or which is a fun debate, or whether you want to allow pictures of Madonnas and child, things like that. Avodah Zarah is an easy instrument to wield, either l'Isra or l'Heter. The Klei Beit HaMikdash thing is something that won't really expand as such outside its narrow categories. So if you frame it around Klei Beit HaMikdash, you want to talk about whether the Machon Mikdash is Mutar or Asar? Okay, you can talk about the Machon Beit HaMikdash is Asar or Mutar. It doesn't matter to me very much, right? And we can have fun afkiminas, about whether it's permitted to paint the cow red. And is it a cow, or, what about if it's a plaster cow, like the Gan, right? Like the Gan cow, are we allowed to paint the Gan cow red, or do we have to make it white and green, or whatever color we do? None of those. The Gan mascot is allegedly a red heifer, but the senior class repaints it all the time.
Well, you
just
paint three white hairs.
Yeah, you can just paint three white hairs. But when the Celtics won, it was white, it was green, and it's lots and lots of different colors. It hasn't been an actual red heifer.
You did a statue of a cow.
Yes.
Oh.
So far, happily, no one has painted it gold. That sounds like more like an Maimonides senior prank, the sneaking one day.
Yeah.
You know, the mascot, the golden calf.
Really? They made a fool, they made the mascot a cow.
The red heifer, yes. The athletic director had a very funny speech seeing off the outgoing associate head, talking about what it meant to walk in as a woman's track coach. And see your mascot was an action. What the self image of the students was supposed to be. But no, it seems to have overcome the stereotypes of students are quite good. Okay. So the point is that you can discuss Avodah Zarah and you can discuss Klei Beit HaMikdash as Klei Beit HaMikdash without touching on the question of what art is. Right, none of them touch really on what artists are trying to do. But when you get into the category which really forces one to talk about that is when you're talking about copying the Shamshin. Right, that's really where you find out it's always usher to have something which is just like something which is really valuable. In what way? What kind of copies? Right? And then the second category, a second question that fits in there is whether we sublimate Adam to one of those categories, whether we somehow say human beings are different entirely. So right, and there that's where the Rambam becomes really highly mysterious as to how he says just Adam, and then he says really mysterious, really, really mysterious. But for yourselves, the question that has to come up is what integration you have in your own approach between working from the sugya up, or whether when you look at it bigadol, you say, well, you know what, it doesn't make any sense to me to say that all representation is forbidden, whether because it doesn't conform to your conception of what plausible human life is, whether because you don't want to believe that every room you've been in every day school classroom in the world is over numerous Yisurim. That's also plausible, right? You might say, you know what? What I am is an Orthodox Jew, an educated Orthodox Jew, and guess what? There were pictures, right? Everywhere I went in elementary school, there were pictures on the wall of my Gedolim. Or when we learned Tfilas HaShachar in sixth grade, right? My rabbi drew a sun with a horizon, right? To teach me, right? To show me the difference between, you know, the various. So you can start your halachic discussion just by saying I'm going to read the sources and the sources will take me wherever they will. You can start it by saying this makes sense to me. This doesn't make sense to me conceptually. I don't believe, I just don't believe that people will really ever thought that any picture was an Avodah Zarah. And if that was the case, like, what's the point of banning pictures? Because there'll be any blade of grass. Right? Or you can start by saying, you know what, I think that my job is to, or my, I think the truth has to be a halacha that conforms to what seems to me to be normal Orthodox life, or that justifies what normal Orthodox life. Now, each of these is interdependent, right? Because you can learn the sugya and then say, you know what? But I have a bunch of options, and I have to pick the ones that fit what my community does. Or now I've learned all the sugya really well. Now I can reject those sugyot that come to conclusions that are absurd in my community. Even if you take the large approach, you still have to fit it into the sugya somehow. Right? But you might feel that if I have a large approach, my goal is not to figure out what pshat in the sugya is. My goal is to figure out which rishonim read the sugya in such a way, because my job is to do only mitzchus. So as long as it turns out that my read of what the halacha of my community is only fits with the Ran, so I'll say, okay, clearly the Masoret is we paskin like the Ran. You can take an even more radical approach and say that my job is not to figure out what the right what the past is, but my job is to figure out what a proper halakha of art would be for the post-1948 world, for life in a constitutional democracy, whatever, right, and start from principles that way, right? In which case, my job, your job is to construct, right, the most radically with what the historians call a usable past. Now you have to find a way to construct this so that it is plausible to you and everybody else that what you're doing is a continuation of the halakha of the past, even though you are aware at the same time that this is not what you would have pasked 50 years ago, or what are now 70 years ago, 60 years ago, up to 70 now, I guess. Okay, tomorrow we're gonna take this kind of approach one step later, which is we're gonna do the position of the Shulchan Aruch. And taking outcomes as opposed to starting from sugyot, right, and getting right and building outcomes out of sugyot, we're gonna take outcomes and try and see how they right and try and see how they relate back to sugyot. What kind of choices did the Shulchan Aruch make? Right, and then we have to decide to what degree we feel bound by the right by the choices the Shulchan Aruch makes. Right, one of the big issues going on here is right is do you think that this is the kind of halakha that is best determined by taking the Shulchan Aruch and just saying, okay, everything that happened before is irrelevant. All that matters is the Shulchan Aruch, and we only read Rishonim and Gemaras because that lets us understand the Shulchan Aruch properly. Or do you say, well, the Shulchan Aruch is one nice datum point from the 16th century, but you know what, halakha is a living thing, and we have access to many, many more Rishonim than the Shulchan Aruch did, which we do. So right, so we can right, and our circumstances are very different. So right, so we'll treat the Shulchan Aruch as a very nice posek to accomplish something. Or we might say that our job is to fit within the technical boundaries of the Shulchan Aruch, without necessarily feeling that we need to continue his svaras. Right, the paskin of the Shulchan Aruch might be that you have to accept his mechanical psakim when he right. So the Shulchan Aruch paskins like Rava against the Baye. We have to paskin like Rava against the Baye. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to understand Rav, that our job is to figure out exactly how the Shulchan Aruch understood Rav and Abaye. That's not his job. His job is just to tell us whom we paskin like. Right, so those are all options that we have. When we finish, the ambition is, I know tomorrow is a fast day, my ambition is tomorrow we'll do that. I think that's what tomorrow is, whether we get to roll in the court or not. The fun of tomorrow is trying to figure out how a Bir Hagra and how the Bir Hagra reconstruction of the Sugya relates to what the Shulchan Aruch actually did or not. Right. Really, do you believe that the Bir Hagra actually related to what the Shulchan Aruch did or not? Because we'll discover, hopefully, is that you'll see that the Shulchan Aruch never actually, in certain areas of halacha, never actually concluded the discussion. It just started a new one. And the new one, and most of the commentaries, and when we talk about the Shulchan Aruch, what we really mean is the Shulchan Aruch plus a set of commentaries for several hundred years that felt free to disagree with him. And we right, and we end up actually, when we paskin with the Shulchan Aruch, we're really paskin is like the consensus that grew up around the Shulchan Aruch over 700 years. Right, when we've done that, so then I would like to spend Wednesday and Thursday reading Tshuvot that will trying to figure out if we can afford to go back and read the medieval Tshuvot extensively, and then take us through the 21st century, and then I'm hoping that the following Monday we can start doing a set of tangential discussions, or not tangential but relevant discussions on Lavinu Lahorot and the Hayudri Mana Eliamzeh, a set of Midrashim on God as an artist, things like that, and that will and that's pretty much where we'll end up. So
are we doing any of the Arayot issues?
I am not planning on directly touching in my shirim any of the issues of how you deal with Arayot. What we will deal with that is in the context, so it's somehow integrated in this, I'm not sure how yet, there's a set of so at least five or six articles that are not Tshuvot, they're articles that I need you to read, some of which will argue directly on this question of how precisely one deals with the category of the erotic. I don't have any sensible, useful halachic categorization. I know what I think is not useful, right, it is not useful is, at least, it seems it's not useful to have, it's not possible that the halacha is obviously that all you do is transfer whatever your standard standard is in real life and transfer it mechanically to paint, right, to painting. Right, that seems to me, right, you know, the example is how you measure a tefach on a, right, on a miniature, and how you measure a tefach on a blown up thing. Right, that doesn't seem to be possible. But other than that, I guess I'll do the 30-second survey. You have two choices. There are three choices. You either try your best mechanical application, right? Or the second category is that you try and make up all sorts of new halakhot based on your best guess of what you think is likely to be erotic and what you think is likely not to be erotic. Right? So we create whole new standards of what constitutes erotic art and what doesn't constitute erotic art. And the last possibility is that we just say, you know what? It's usher to do things that generate hirurim. Except when such things are desirable. And leave it at that. And we don't set any standards at all. Right, that aren't subjective. My preference would be to go for something closer to the letter rather than trying to... The mechanical standards, you know, like we'll end up with discussions, right? Are you going to that painting show? I don't know. One of the artists, Paskin Zeichner of Henkin, about Sayer Bisha Erva. Oh, that's fine. I don't think Sayer Bisha Erva is really an erotic issue anyway. Right? That's what we say, right? That's what the decision whether to go to an art museum is going to be like. Right? It's going to depend on which shita about Sayer Bisha Erva you hold like, and we'll have to be people going to the, right, going. We'll have to have the, you know, the official tenders going to the museum, right, and say, this painting is mutter according to shita so-and-so. This painting is mutter according to shita, right, so-and-so. I can't imagine that is the right outcome. So we decide we walk down the street anyway, right? Practically, we don't have standards. Practically, no one actually says to halacha whom you're allowed to look at. We just said to halacha how women are allowed to dress.
Right.
And
if we're talking about this, it could be the halacha of what you're allowed to make.
So right. So we said, but I don't think the thing is right that all right people are entitled to ask for guidance about what right about dress. Truthfully, I would much rather we didn't set. Objective dress codes in some way either also if we could do it by some kind of communal standard, right, natural communal standard, I think it would be much. When you try to enforce dress codes, right, they collapse. All schools find it out. Any dress code that has to be enforced as opposed to a principle that's inculcated ends up being counterproductive in many, many cases. So I would much rather not set up. I also think that, you know, it will generate... There is now in Israel, there's a fun school of art that is dedicated basically just to making fun of these restrictions. It's all about making jokes of various kinds of Isurim. Along the lines of all the women singing groups being called Kalisha. They're all framed that way. It doesn't matter whether they do it to take advantage of the tamer or not. I just don't see that as the right approach, although I recognize that let's suppose there were a midrasha that was setting up to try and attract Americans, right, so for their market, right, that's what they're going to need to do, right? Right, they need to be able to have visiting rabbis come into their school and look at the paintings and decide their own mutter. And if they don't have standards in Tzach, it'll actually be more constraining rather than less constraining, because then they're always, because then anything on the border they can't defend. Right? If you don't have the halakhic standards can liberate, right? Because if they say, you know what, our posek told us that you can do anything you want in profile. Right? So then even if somebody does some kind of cool something like a cool shtick that bothers them, but our posek said, right, so Tzach is protective, and so I understand that there is value in having absolute standards because it frees, ironically not because it is likely to restrict artists, but because it's likely to free artists. But not having any specific community that I am responsible for or that I can protect, that means that anything that I said is likely only to just go on, you know, become part of a dueling a dueling standards campaign, which everybody, you know, what one group called the other people's art strafe, because it's too erratic, and the other, right? So I don't see any point in putting out another standard in an environment where I have no authority. I was interested in trying to see if I could go after Lo Saussure and see if we could talk about the whole prohibition of thought, but I haven't found a way to do it. So I will likely let others address that. It's interesting historically, and Rabbi David Sperber, who's Professor Rabbi Dr. Sperber's son, is the advisor to a journal of Israeli modern art. So he takes the most harif position. That basically argues, as I understand it, you'll read it, that halacha needs to function within the categories of the artistic world, and the artistic world has its own definitions of what constitutes erotic and what constitutes pornographic, in which the erotic is artistic and the pornographic is not, and also is capable of making distinctions between the beauty of the body and the erotic. Which we can decide or not. Right? This is, you'll see. He talks about. He ties explicitly the distinction whether he argues halacha needs to introduce into its reasonings the distinction that Kenneth Clark famously made between the nude and the naked. Right? And that's why we use the nude as the category in art, right? Because the nude is not seen as exploitative, but the naked is seen as exploitative. I had a whole conversation with Chava over Shabbos. Over a painting of Picasso that I happened to run into in a thrift shop, and which is
a thrift shop.
I ran into a print that was selling portfolios. Portfolios. I said, here I am in the Gansam Arist, but here's a Picasso. Here's a collection of Picasso. It's cheap. Maybe I should pick it up so I can study it. And I picked it up. I looked at them, and certainly one of them was of a woman who was unclothed. It was utterly unerotic. Although it was evil. That was the whole question. It was just evil. That I hold the whole question over on Shabbat about whether it's meaningful. Whether it's meaningful to describe certain art as evil, and why. I thought that piece of Picasso's was genuinely evil. If Picasso had taken that painting and clothed the model, right? So. Perhaps it would be mutter, but it would still be evil. So what would be the use? He was a great enough painter, right? That he could have put one giant fig leaf over the whole, right, over the whole figure, and it would still have been an evil painting. I'm not at this stage, and I'll tell you when we get there. This is not a psak that the psak that what one is allowed to look at in museums is not a. Not something that ought to be done objectively, but rather subjectively. Is something that I have the masoret from various prominent poskim, in that they paskin for my friends who asked the shaila and were told they could go. I'm not sure as part of my ambulance. I'm not sure I'm allowed to quote their names or not because they paskin for their friends who told me in confidence. I'm comfortable at this stage saying, and I'll have to work out for myself, and I'm comfortable saying in the long run that by saying that. If I take that position, I think I am taking a position which has been a standard psak in the religious Zionist world for some time. That's the psak that people got in various yeshivot, not just Aratzion, that they were allowed to go to museums. And museums, if they were news, they didn't have to look away automatically. They have to make decisions for themselves as to what the impact on the neshama would be of looking at it. At this stage, I don't see any basis for doing more than that. Although somebody else can give something, can do something different, but I'm not going to do it. All right. Thank you all very much again.
Yeah.